We all owe them, but very few of us know them. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities. And these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to American Warrior Radio. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. Their motto is First There, and it's derived from their World War II history of being inserted ahead of the other troops in order to provide critical information like weather details or physical visual guidance for inbound aircraft. Originally known as the Army Pathfinders, when the Air Force became a separate branch, their title was changed to Combat Controllers. Now, Combat Controllers are among some of the most highly trained personnel in all of our military, and they've got a diverse set of skills: air traffic control, joint terminal attack control, parachuting, combat diving skills, explosives. These guys can do it all. Now, the Air Force Cross is the branch's second highest decoration for extraordinary heroism in combat, second only to the Medal of Honor. Since the Global War on Terror, 11 Air Crosses have been awarded. At least five of those have been pinned on the chest of combat controllers. Today, we're going to talk to two men who have worn the Scarlet Beret. They're both associated with the Combat Control Foundation. First up, Mike LaMonica, who is on the board of directors and one of the founding members. Mike, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Ben, thanks for having me. How are you doing today?
I'm just peachy keen, sir. That's not a phrase you hear on the radio much. And secondly, joining us, also a founding member of the Combat Control Foundation, Mike West. Mike, too, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Ben, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I look forward to the discussion.
I tell you what, having two Mikes on the show at the same time could give me a brain cramp. So, Mike LaMonica, if you don't mind, I'm just going to call you L.A., okay?
That's perfect. That's what I go by most of the time.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
So, L.A., what's your story? 24 years as an Air Force combat controller. I saw another interview you did, and it kind of reminded me of when you see the interviews they did with the real Band of Brothers, the soldiers featured in the Band of Brothers. So many of them said, I want to become a paratrooper because I want to serve with the best. Is that sort of your story too?
It is. You know, it's interesting. When I was going to join the military, Godfather was a special forces in Vietnam, and that's what I wanted to do. Just before I joined the service, my dad said, hey, special forces, you need to know the language. Well, at that point in my life, too late. We didn't have the internet. We didn't know how to research things before we got into them. So I went, well, I'll go join the Air Force. And while I was in basic training, I heard about combat control and pararescue. I went to briefing, and I quickly realized that's where I wanted to be. The guys who were in the room who were talking and the students were in the course at the time who were there, they just all had this presence about them. They were focused on the military mission. They weren't there for college. They were there to go do something very purposeful. And that inspired me. So I went up the next week. I made it by the skin of my teeth as far as getting in the front door. And I spent the next year and a half proving myself worthy of being there. And then, you know, in October of 1988, I was able to don the Scarlet Beret. And I will tell you, the day I graduated, I knew I was the wife. I've always had this fest with military people. They as growing up watching adults make decisions, the people who were most confident and spoke with the most surety were the people who had veteran experience, and the closer to the front lines they were, the more clear they were. And I wanted to be that type of person. So when I graduated the Combat Control Pipeline, I went, I'm doing this for the rest of my life. This is where I belong. And that proved my entire career. Even later in my career, as we were heavily in combat, I thought, man, I'd probably be an okay SEAL. I'd probably be an okay combat controller or a Marine, or a Special Forces Marine. But combat control was the home for me. The job was intriguing. It's a difficult and a technical job. A lot rests on one person's shoulders, and I thrive in that environment. Steel sharpens steel. So I was around some of the best people on the planet, and I wouldn't be the person I am today without having been raised by a bunch of combat controllers and pararescue men.
Boy, and that's a perfect descriptive phrase, steel sharpens steel. Mike West, what is your story? You had 30 years in. What first attracted you to combat controller?
Yeah, so mine's a little different path, not too much off, but my first recruiter, I actually had two recruiters growing up. It was both my grandfathers. One served in the Navy and one served in the Air Force. The one that served in the Air Force was one I got to spend a lot of time with, is one I spent my summers with, and he often would take me to the Air Force Base, Little Rock Air Force Base. He would often take me to the base, and he would show me the guys how sharp they look, how they were happy. You know, I go one day, we'd just go sit out the fly line, watch airplanes land, and one day the space shuttle was in there. It was on the back of the 747. They just stopped in, and I mean, I just thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And he did a really good job making me feel comfortable with that. Like I knew the Air Force is where I wanted to go. I mean, I knew it all through high school. Everybody kept asking, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? I'll go, I want to be in the Air Force. I started looking at some jobs at one time, and air traffic control was one of them. There were some other ones in there. And then, right before I went to the Air Force recruiter, a couple of buddies of mine, took me scuba diving. They took me scuba diving and I loved it. Like, I just loved it. Like, it was just the best thing ever. So I walked in the Air Force recruiter's office, and, he's like, great. Like, what do you want to do? And I'm like, man, I want to scuba dive. And he's like, you're in the wrong office.
Go to the Navy.
I'm like, yeah, I'm like, nope. I go, I know I want to be in the Air Force. I know that for a fact, but man, I want to scuba dive. And he's like, I'm sorry, but, he goes, let me go look around. Let's see if we can find something close. Well, he came back with a rip. With combat control on there, and on that was air traffic control school and scuba diving at the, you know, it's when we just started, putting scuba diving in our training, and, man, there it all lined up. I'm like, that's what I want to do. Now little did I know there was going to be, you know, this intense training pipeline that was going to go through, you know, it was going to be a year and a half long, and, I knew it was going to be long, but I didn't know what it was going to, you know, entail, especially at the beginning of it, which, you know, we had to try out. And like Michael, Monica, you know, we show up at a school with a bunch of other studs. You're like, I'm going to be a combat controller. But, you know, the instructors are, you know, they have different thoughts. They know they're going to have to figure out who really wants to be in the training. And some of those guys are going to be the needs of the Air Force, and some of those guys are going to be combat controllers. It's kind of a gut check, but it's really putting you in the best shape of your life. You know, we go through this training, it starts off, it's a couple months long, but, you know, we had a lot of people. I had 120 people that I started with, some of them that were in my basic training class. But when we got done, we finished with a large class. We had 14, and half of those were, pararescue men. The other half are combat controllers. But when we graduated after a couple months, you gain family members, so to speak.
We've got just a couple minutes for the first break, but so that you train in parallel with the PJs, and then once you graduate, then you go off to specialized training, right?
Well, and we spend some of the training with each other, because right after our first school, we go to dive school, and we went to a couple of jump schools, and we go to survival school. We went through those together, but then once we kind of broke off from the pararescue guys, we head off to air traffic control school, and they start heading on to some of their medical, part, and some of their, you know, their high angle rescue, some of the, you know, the things that they're specialized in versus what we're specialized in. So we kind of branch off from each other. But to this day, I still stay in touch with all those teammates, that I was started off with, kind of like what Michael Monica's saying, you gain some brotherhoods in there. But those are also, you know, I call them family members, because I'd be there in a heartbeat if they needed something.
So is it like with other special forces, you've got a sniper, you've got a breacher, you might have a demolitions person, but are all combat controllers trained in all of these? I mean, everybody's dive qualified, everybody's an air traffic controller?
No, not everybody's qualified. Not everybody. It all depends. We have our core skills, which is really a lot of the needs for the Air Force. You know, the air traffic control part, we can work our radios, we can go out, we can help airplanes land, we can develop a landing runway anywhere, whether it be a highway, an airfield that was once belonged to somebody else. We can go in there and set it up, start landing airplanes, start on a highway, and it may even be a resupply for any kind of coalition or joint partner that we might be assigned to, but we're there to assist. That's the primary. Now, those other skills may reach out to doing other things depending on who we're working with. And some of our guys have become very specialized in some things. And so, you know, like one of them, tell an airplane where to drop bombs.
Okay, when we come back after the break, I want to talk more about that training pipeline. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to American Warrior Radio. If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider helping us spread the word by directing your friends to AmericanWarriorRadio.com. You can also contact your local radio station and encourage them to add American Warrior Radio to their programming. Thank you. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with Mike LaMonica and Mike West. Both of them were founding members of the Combat Control Foundation. You can learn more, visit combatcontrol.team. So, L.A., back to you. I saw a, you know, people think about BUDS, the Navy SEALs training, and just how intense that is and what a high dropout rate there is. But I saw a National Geographic feature on pararescue and combat control training where the dropout rate is higher in that training, I think. Is that accurate? Or?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's debatable. Right? Any given year, you look at statistics and you make numbers look at what they want. But I will tell you historically, since Mike and I came in decades ago, that the dropout rate of combat control is about 85%. So if 100 people start, about 15 people graduate. And that the numbers Mike talked about, his class started with 120, and they graduated 14. My class started with about the same thing. We graduated with 15. And what I'll tell you is all the courses in SOF, the selection courses, whether it's Rangers or Special Forces, you go overseas to British SAS or Australian SAS or the Polish Grum, there are high washout rates. And what's going on there is you have people who are volunteering to come to work in a very high-risk job and a very dangerous job to be in, and they're tough to do. So the criteria to get through the training is very selective. It's physically, mentally, and emotionally demanding. And to be able to be locked on every day for 18 months in all three of those areas, physical, emotional, and mental, it's just a difficult thing to do. There is a very high washout rate. A lot of people wash out because of the water. Water is very difficult. It's an element, or it adds an element that people just aren't naturally ready for when you stress somebody out in that area. But then you also have things like air traffic control school, which is not easy.
Well, and
every day there is a physical endeavor. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, that's I'm glad you brought that up because I saw an interview you did where you mentioned that. And I don't normally when we think about secret squirrels, we're thinking about the physical part of it. But yeah, I mean, not only have to be physically fit that you can survive the pool training and sear and all that stuff, but you got to know how to land and direct planes and artillery and. We're talking some pretty complex stuff there. Would you say the dropout rate when it got to the air traffic control part of it was higher or about the same as the physical qualifications?
I would say if I was going to rank them in order, physical is the highest dropout rate, especially when you get to the water. That is where you lose most of your people. I would say mental is another. And what I mean by mental isn't intelligence. It's the stress of what's going to happen the next day. While you have a schedule, you don't know what's happening minute to minute, and you have to adapt to the ever-changing environment that the instructors are creating for you. The intellectual piece very much is a part of that. But what I'll tell you is when guys make it through the initial selection process, there's a pretty high graduation rate, about 90%. Because they want to be there. I had guys in my class who really struggled with air traffic control, but they made up for it in raw horsepower. They would stay up till midnight studying, and, you know, it's not just the studying. It's like the actual practical application of working in a three-dimensional environment when you're moving airplanes in a combat space and you're not just worried about the planes, but you're worried about rounds going towards them and what's going on around you. That just takes a lot of effort. The guys may struggle with that, but because they've worked so hard to be there, they will work extra hard to stay there. I hope that helps answer the question you asked.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting. You and I both have been using the term guys, but you had your first woman graduate, I want to say, back in April as a combat controller.
We sure did.
That's cool.
That's right. Yeah, it's impressive. She has, you know, she worked really hard to get where she is, and she's still finishing up her training. Probably not appropriate to be using her name because she's in the active duty forces right now, but I look forward to seeing how she navigates her career, because while she has made it through and she has earned the badges and she's earned the beret, this is very much a male-dominated world. And when any of us show up to the unit brand new, we got to remember that we are brand new. But then we also are going to get tested every single day by the people we're around, because that's how steel sharpens steel. Sure. Well, with her, she has the added element of being a woman, and people are always going to question that. And I've not met her personally. I saw her when I was on a trip back in September. She looked like she's got it together, okay. And the people around her seem to have a great deal of respect for her. So I wish nothing but the best for her.
Mike West, I saw Air Force video of when you were the medal presentation for when you were awarded the Silver Star. And Lieutenant General Brad Webb, in his comments, he said part of being a combat controller is it's about figuring out how to solve problems, knowing there's a way, and you're going to find the way to get that done. So a lot of it for a successful combat controller is attitude.
Attitude is a big part of it. It's just one part of what may identify a guy or be a definition of a combat controller. But there's a lot of part of it. A lot of them is professionalism, and to go with that attitude, you got to have it, because what you may find is you find a lot of our guys may be working alone. They may be by themselves, attached to a special forces team or a SEAL team or some other, and they're required to work alone. So they, they've got a lot of responsibility, and sometimes it may even be a young team leader who has some younger guys with them, and they have a big responsibility where they're going out to do a mission or they're doing something. Maybe they're landing airplanes, out in the middle of nowhere. And, they've got to have that part, that attitude that you're kind of bringing up. So one, to get the mission done, but also to lead others and also to coordinate, communicate, to make everything happen.
Mike, when we come back from the commercial break, if you'd be willing, I'd like you to share a little bit about Operation Medusa. That was the series of battles for which you were awarded, and your actions there for which you were awarded the Silver Star. But I think it's also a perfect example of the diversity of things that the combat controllers can bring to the fight. Can we talk about that when we come back? Is that okay with you?
Sure. Yeah, that'd be fine.
Okay. Just before the break, you can learn more, visit combatcontrol.team. When we come back, we'll also talk with these two founding members of the Combat Control Foundation about the foundation, who they are, what they do, why there was a need for it, and lots more information, folks. Listen, you can find over 500 podcasts. Visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com. You're also streaming on your favorite platform, whatever it is. If it's Amazon, if it's iTunes, iHeart, you can find us there. And, of course, you can follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, all that social media these kids nowadays use. Ladies and gentlemen, again, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be back with more here on American Warrior Radio. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia, your host. We're speaking with Mike LaMonica and Mike West, both of them combined 54 years as Air Force combat controllers. They're both also founding members of the Combat Control Foundation. You can learn more about that. Visit combatcontrol.team, T-E-A-M. Mike West, I saw a video about when you were presented the Silver Star, and it was described for your work involvement in something called Operation Medusa, and seeing what happened during that operation is the perfect example of the diverse skill sets that combat controllers bring to the fight and how they're really force multipliers. So this involved a Taliban stronghold, and the bad guys were threatening Kandahar. And kind of take it from there, if you don't mind. And Mike LaMonica, L.A., if you want to jump in and add something, feel free.
Yeah, so this was 2006. I was assigned to a special forces team. I was the, and, you know, what we did for the special forces teams is we were their sort of, you know, so to speak, their Air Force support and coalition aircraft. But we're there to help them. You know, you're assigned to teams that, you know, they're a bunch of, so to speak, door kickers, snipers, guys that love to shoot, guys that love, you know, to perform operations, in very close environments, particularly. But what you bring to them is you bring a lot of the support that aircraft bring. You know, you're that guy with a radio, that is just as deadly as they are. But that radio, and I used to have conversations with them. They're like, well, what's your job? They'd always ask me, you know, sometimes you get guys you just don't know or what. But, you know, they go, what's your job? I go, look, your job, when we get in a firefight, your job is to keep me alive for 15 minutes, and then I'll take over. And they'll be like, what? But then once they kind of see what that means, they'll be like, oh, yeah, okay, now I see. Because the what you bring is not only just the United States Air Force, but our coalition aircraft. We have the best Air Force in the world. But then when you put our supporting coalition aircraft in that mix, man, we're unstoppable, in my opinion, at times. It's just a great environment. But Medusa is an example of that. So I would, you know, here I'm assigned to a team, and my team gets teamed up with two other special forces teams, and there's another Air Force combat controller, a young guy that's with us. He's on another team. It's his first deployment, our job is just to sit. We're working in this area just west of Kandahar. It's called Panjaway. And our job was just to sit in the south part of this region. The Canadians, along with the Afghanis, were going to roll through this area that was known to be a bad guy area. The Russians had trouble in this area when the Russians were there. But they were just going to roll through, and we were just to sit in the south. That's all they wanted us to do at this Operation Medusa, just sit there. But when the Canadians tried to start the mission with the Afghanis, they hit a lot of resistance. They hit a lot of IEDs. The bad guys were waiting on them, and they had to pull back. And they kept trying, and they just had a lot of casualties. And they kept pulling back. They're on the verge of even canceling the whole mission. Well, our mission changed a little bit, and through the communications with our overall team leader, and we were able to move forward. There was a hill inside of this region, and we were determined to occupy it. And we got approval to do that. And once we moved up to this hill, the plan was we're just going to park at the bottom, and we were going to dismount four people, four special forces guys. I was considered one of them. They wanted me with the team leader and with some Afghanis. Afghani special forces guys, we were there training them. We were there getting them ready, and but we're just going to dismount. And we're going to clear the top of this thing. The top of this hilltop is probably about 400 yards wide, maybe less.
How many? At the end of the day, how many Taliban were there? Do you have an estimate?
There were a lot. this whole region was covered with them. And when all this operation started to kick off, all the civilians left the area. We watched them leave to the west in droves. They knew something. They knew it was all going to come down. There's a lot of bad guys there.
And your teams, I think I heard, is three Green Beret OD Operational Detachment Alpha groups, which is what, 15?
Three special forces. It ranges in size, but they're around 15. Okay. I have a junior, senior guy, and they got the team leader and a few others. But, yeah, they have it's right around 15. That all depends. Sometimes a little smaller. Sometimes they're a little bigger, but most of the time they're 12 to 15-ish. And we also have our own Afghani counterparts with us who they were training. You look at probably had per ODA team had about 15 Afghanis, maybe 15 to 20 Afghanis that were assigned to them. So they have their trucks with ours. And then we had three special forces teams. So that all kind of added up. But the plan was we're just going to pull up to this mountaintop and we were going to stop all the vehicles, and then we'd dismount and go up there and clear it out. There were some buildings up there we're going to go check out and some other stuff just to look at the area before we brought everybody up there. Just so, because it gave us a little bird's eye view of the area, put us up a little bit higher, which kind of makes sense. It made sense to me, but when they said, hey, I was going to be part of the group, you know, I brought along a couple A-10s to put overhead to give us eyes plus, you know, a little backside support. And so when we dismounted, I had two A-10s overhead, you know, and I was with three Special Forces guys in this Afghani team, and we went up on top of this, and there was a building up there. It was an old UNICEF school. They tried to get started, but the Taliban turned it down. So it was just an empty building. The building had been occupied by the Taliban. You could see by the paperwork, all the stuff that was there. They quickly identified that was probably their home at one time, if not recently. And then we went around, and as we went around the building, there's another little higher ground. We went up on the higher ground, and I was standing next to the team leader and one of the Afghani soldiers that was with us. And next thing you know, we hear there's just a big explosion. It was right beside us. I thought something impacted. We both got dirt blown all over us, and we just kind of turned to the side. And when we kind of, you know, when we got our bearing, we're like, what's going on? What's going on? But the guy, the Afghani that was standing with us, had stepped on a anti-personnel mine, and he was blown off the side. And we're like, oh my gosh, this place is probably covered. The team leader and I are looking at each other. We look at him. We run down to him. We both took our tourniquets out and applied it to, he had a severed leg. We applied the tourniquets, and we decided, hey, we need to get off this, we need to get off this hilltop. There's potentially others. And as we're putting the tourniquets on it, the rest of the Afghanis grab their injured soldier, and we're exiting back to the vehicles. Well, the vehicles had heard this explosion, and they got concerned, and one of them comes up on top of the hill where we're at. He goes by, but then the second vehicle in front of us runs over an IED. It explodes, and this was basically what the enemy was waiting on, was this really, they were waiting on that vehicle to run over. They knew it was going to happen, or they were anticipating it, but we started taking fire from both sides of this hilltop.
Well, Mike, we're going to have to take another break here in about a minute, but I apologize because we're right in the middle of the story. But so this was over 50, I think I read it was 15 troops in combat battles over the course of how many days?
About a week.
Wow. You guys were just getting lit up for a week.
And most of that, I mean, it wasn't just during the day. We had AC-130 gunships at nighttime. That first night I had, for the first two or three nights, I had two gunships that were above me. And those guys, you know, in support. So it's about to kick off. I had a lot of airplanes supporting me. I had them throughout the day. I had them throughout the night. And when I say, you know, we've got one of the best air forces in conjunction with our coalition forces, aircraft, you know, we just got some of the best support in the world, especially to the ground troops. And that's something I always hope that, you know, our Congress will follow how important it is to support the troops. And, you know, sure, Everybody loves the A-10. You know, as long as we keep something like that, you know, in the air above us, we'll always be successful, especially, you know, that can find all the friendlies, find all the enemies, and keep us safe.
When we come back, I want to just close this up, and then we're going to bring Mike LaMonica back on to talk about the Combat Control Foundation and just the great things you guys are doing for these very, very special warriors. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. We can learn more. Visit combatcontrol.team. We'll be back after just these few messages. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Mike LaMonica and Mike West. They're both founding members of the Combat Control Foundation. You can learn more by visiting combatcontrol.team, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about that. But Mike West, just want to sort of finish the story about the action Operation Medusa, for which, well, your role in which you were awarded the Silver Star. I think I read, Mike, at any point in time, you or maybe in total, you were communicating with and coordinating 88 fixed and rotary wing aircraft?
Yeah, after the week was over, it was somewhere right around that. I had multiple aircraft support me, not the ones that were stationary. They also had an aircraft carrier. The Enterprise was just off. They moved it. It was deployed over to support us. So I had F-18s supporting me, and there's just a number of other. It was just great. You know, when you got, you know, and I'd have, you know, at the time, Predators, you know, supporting me. They would check in. You know, they're going, hey, we're here for 26 hours. What do you want us to do? So I just had a lot of airplanes that were helping us out. And it wasn't just about, you know, dropping weapons. Some of them were just watching our back. So we always knew what was going on. And it was all about, you know, protecting forces and, you know, whatever it took. These are guys that didn't like us, but it was protecting our forces. We were protecting our coalition forces, our joint partners. And they were all very appreciative, especially afterwards. Especially the team that I was working with, they were very, very appreciative. And, you know, they gave me a great gift one time, you know, months after the deployment. They invited me back just so they could get, you know, all chip in, give me a great gift. It meant more than anything they wrote me up for, but it was just something. That just tells me they appreciated everything I was doing.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, just Google Mike's name and you'll, that Air Force video will come up, and it's just an amazing story. I mean, you're directing A-10s on strafing runs, danger close, I think is not even is probably an understatement for that. So, but I think I wanted you to tell that story because it really describes the capabilities that combat controllers bring to the fight. L.A., Michael, Monica, let's talk a little bit about the Combat Control Foundation and what you're doing. Both you and Mike West were founding members. What was the trigger that inspired you to create this foundation?
What comes with the rigors of a combat controller, right? So, you know, to sum up what you and Mike were talking about, what a combat controller brings to the table is you got one person who comes in and can change the entire battlefield. It's an asymmetric warfare capability, right? One combat controller with 15 special forces guys or 15 SEALs can literally take on hundreds or thousands of the enemy. And we've got numerous stories across the 20 years of Afghanistan and Iraq to display that. Well, what comes with that is an immense amount of pressure. You take a young person out of high school, they go through a 2-year training pipeline, they're one of 15 people out of hundreds who tried that actually make it. When they graduate, they go to their squadron, 6 months later they're deployed, and they're deployed not with their team, but they're deployed with an element that is either a U.S. element, a SEALs or Rangers or SF, or maybe even a foreign team, the Australian SAS or British SAS or something like that. Guys they've never met before. They step on the ground, and within days, they're in firefights. That's a lot of stress to put on a human being. And the families have the same amount of stress, right? We take a guy from his wife and his children. We take him halfway around the world. We put him in this environment where he's not able to talk to them because he's gone for long periods of time. And the wife is seeing other guys come home injured. They're watching other wives have to deal with their husbands who are injured or killed in action. And long term, that just causes a lot of turmoil. Physical injuries, their mental injuries, and we are now dealing with a lot of that. So as Mike and I were on the association together, we're on the board together, we were fielding phone calls every week with people who needed help. And we just didn't know how to help them. We didn't have the resources. So we said, what we need to do is we need to stand up a foundation. And, you know, us plus four or five other guys, we put this thing together. And in 2021, we really just started to raise money towards it. And that took off. And when you start raising money and have resources to be able to help people, people actually start coming out of the woods and asking for help. It's a hard thing to ask for help in the first place. But when you see that your teammates are getting help and you know that you may need it, you actually come out of the woodwork and ask. So what we're dealing with now is we have some programs, and they fall under the pillars of health, resilience, education, and heritage. And every dollar we raise goes towards taking care of one of those four programs. The bulk of it, I would say, is health and resilience. We have a lot of people who are dealing with decades of trauma that, you know, their career put on top of them. We have spouses who have challenges that need help. Then we have some even simpler things like, you know, kids who are now graduating high school. And, you know, when you retire from the military as an enlisted person, you have a retirement check, but that's not getting your kids through college. So we have a scholarship program that helps children or spouses take on college classes. So those are the types of things that we're helping people with. the need is enormous. We're a very small community, and the systems that are out there to help, like the VA or the Air Force or other systems like that, while they're there and they do a decent job, they have big gaps because they're big bureaucracies, and they just can't turn as fast as we need them to.
At any given time, how many combat controllers are there?
On active duty, there's about 350 combat controllers at any given time.
Wow.
Across all time, there's about 3,800 of them.
Okay. Well, I tell you, we're handling the heritage part of it today, I think, in some ways.
Yeah.
Mike West, coming back to talk about the foundation, it made me think about General Webb's comments about figuring out how to solve problems. It sounds like you and L.A. were identifying or had identified some gaps, so you just, typical of your discipline, you decided to find a solution.
I mean, it goes back to what I said at the beginning. I mean, we didn't just game, you know, teammates and friends. We gained family members, so to speak. And you feel very passionate about it. Like, you see these people, like, it's like, God forbid, when something happens to one, you're losing part of you when somebody dies. And then when you see their families, like, you want to help out. You want to help out those that have invisible wounds, that have, you know, stuff happening. And there may be gaps, just like what Mike is saying. There may be gaps in places. There's a lot of great programs out there, but sometimes not all those programs cover everything as they're trying to figure things out. Some things may be new. Some may be a little bit different. Everything has a little different, specialty to it that we have to figure out, that we try to help problem solve. But it just allows us to fill in some of those gaps with some of these guys, help them out. Maybe, you know, some things they can't get covered and we can try to help out. Or maybe it's, you know, just helping them at their home, helping out, you know, if the guy is disabled, maybe we can help them out doing something for them or doing something for their family members just to make life just a little bit better. And we're very passionate about it. We both serve, and we'll continue to serve probably till the day we die. Like some of the people who are on the board with each other. It's just part of what we do. And it's our way of giving back. We love these guys and we'll continue to take care of them.
Mike and Mike, we've got listeners from coast to coast, from California to Virginia, and I encourage all of them to visit combatcontrol.team to find out more how you can support. Are there other volunteer opportunities where you can, a force multiplier, if you will? You've got other folks around the country who can step in depending on where this combat controller is living?
Yeah, we do this. In fact, we're always looking for that. And we're always looking for capability. And I'd say the biggest thing is clearly money helps us solve problems, but being linked into other organizations that provide offerings, whether that offering is a psychological type help or, you know, there's other organizations out there who, you know, buy houses or cars for people. You know, we have people all over the country and across our generations that need help. We had a guy who was a guy who was suffering some serious PTSD from doing stuff down in South America during the drug wars. And he, you know, he was homeless and serious attention. And we had some other organizations step in and help us with him as well. So, the limit of volunteer is unlimited. If there are people out there who think they can help us, happy to have a conversation. I know we have many people in our own community who step in and spend a lot of volunteer time, to include the wives. The wives are a big force enabler for us.
You know, gentlemen, it's been just a privilege to have both of you on the show here. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough time. And before we break, though, I want to say two things. One is, combat controllers, it's not just about putting lead on foreheads. You're also a huge asset when it comes in times of natural disaster and some other things where folks might need some help. And then, Mike, LaMonica, just one thing I want to mention, because it's being a fan of history, it really stuck out to me. During your career, you made 4 combat jumps. And I think we almost have to go back to World War II to find somebody who's made that number of combat jumps. Right? Or am I crazy?
Yeah, that's a correct statement. And you know, the humble me says, like, I was a guy in a place who happened to be able to do it at any given time. But the person who wants to brag about combat controllers, that's the great thing about the capability. Any combat controller is prepared to do anything anywhere. And all they need is their backpack and whatever employment method they're using.
Outstanding.
And that's a neat thing as far as capability goes. You talk about humanitarian. Back in 2010, when the Haiti earthquake hit, the general launched combat controllers within 12 hours. We had people on the ground landing airplanes. And they were there for 10 days.
Wow.
All the humanitarian aid that went into Haiti that year went into a combat controller.
We've got to wrap it up. Both mics, thank you so much for being here on American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. Archived episodes may be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com or your favorite podcast platform.